This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent wherever they may live in the world, and certainly very vital for all the people of the world. As you know, I've been doing a spoken word version of my book, Jewish Supremacism. It's free. It's available for you now. I'm in Chapter 6, Jewish Political Supremacy, and today we're going to be doing the second part of three parts of that chapter. It's a very important chapter. It deals with the mechanisms of Jewish extremist power in the government of the United States and the influence they have over government policy. It's illustrated quite well by the carnage that's going on in Lebanon, a carnage that's not only against the human rights and the decency that America should be showing, but it's literally against every true interest of the United States of America. We've gone to war, or supported a country going to war against a nation where we had vital economic and political interests, a nation that was friendly to the United States, and we even supported Israel while to attack this nation while 25,000 Americans were there in harm's way. One more perfect example of the control of American foreign policy by this Jewish extremist minority. But you can listen to the book for yourself and make your own conclusions, and I think you're going to find this part of this chapter very interesting. And we're going to take up where we left off in some of the exercise of power in our government. And and you're going to find some of the facts, I think, and statistics incredibly interesting and actually quite frightening. So here it is, part two of the sixth chapter of Jewish Supremacism, Jewish Political Supremacy. The primary use of Jewish power in Washington, obviously, is to promote Jewish and Zionist interests, such as our pro-Israel policy. In that area, Israel has all her bases covered. The president's top security advisors, such as Sandy Berger and Leon Perth, are dedicated Zionists, and they have Jews in the critical positions of Secretary of Defense William Cohen and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. When the United States mediates Middle East peace talks between the Palestinians and the Israeli Prime Minister, Dennis Ross is the chief arbitrator, a nice, as they say, warm Jew. Is it any wonder that Palestinians feel that they are not getting a fair shake when the so-called mediators of the conflict are as dedicated a bunch of Zionists as are the official representatives of Israel? The hypocrisy goes on and on. Salon Magazine, in February 17, 1997 article by their Washington correspondent Jonathan Broder, a writer for the Jerusalem Report, by the way, had this to say, quote, Washington, following the recent revelations about Madeleine Albright's Jewish roots, the new U.S. Secretary of State faces a new conundrum. All her top candidates for a slew of senior positions in the State Department are Jewish and male. A number of foreign policy experts have been quick to note the exquisiteness of the irony. It suggests that we've come a long way in this country from the days when the Foreign Service was reserved for very WASPy elite, says former National Security Council Middle East advisor Richard Haass, who now directs foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. As a side note, my friends, you see, this goes right along with what we're talking about in terms of takeover of Russia during the Bolshevik Revolution, except this was not quite as a bold takeover as that, but it's just been a very quiet but very powerful subversion of our government, a removal of us from the positions of power and a placing of themselves in the positions of power. Yes, there are many Gentiles. George Bush apparently is a Gentile. But let me tell you, these guys know where their bread is buttered. Let's go on. When Albright traveled to the Balkans, she attacked the immorality of Croatia for not allowing refugees to return. But she makes no similar moral demands for Israel to allow the return of the million Palestinian refugees it's banned for decades. As any group seeking power would understand, economic prowess is the next important component of control after directly administered political power. Jewish power in the economic processes of our country is practically monolithic. Many of these positions, of course, change from time to time, but as of this writing, in the last term of President Clinton, Jews hold all the most powerful economic positions. The most powerful position of all is the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, and it's interesting to note that this critical economic appointee, Alan Greenspan, has remained in office through both Republican and Democratic administrations. And as a side note, of course, he's replaced, it's a Jewish seat, by another Jewish supremacist. And this will, I'm sure, continue as long as they hold power in Washington. Are Americans so naive as to believe that this cohesive, ethnocentric people of immense wealth do not share information and network with their brethren for their own benefit? In the section on Jewish economic strategy within my upcoming chapter on the roots of anti-Semitism, I point out how in the economic sphere, early knowledge of government policy or access to other privileged government information is worth countless billions of dollars in the marketplace. As I discovered these things, I asked myself, do these economic czars have an opportunity to advance their own common interests? Does not reason suggest that they have pressed their own economic interests in the same way they have advanced their interests in America's pro-Israel policy? Jewish interests go far beyond Israel and economic policy. The top advisors of the President of the United States influence every area of American life, from welfare to taxes, immigration to criminal justice. Imagine and consider their influence on the appointment of federal judges alone. In my own federal court district, the Eastern District of Louisiana, which has only a very small Jewish population, Jews constitute a third of the sitting federal judges. On the Supreme Court of the United States, there are currently 2 Jews and 7 Gentiles. Jews often have had specific agendas in the areas of civil rights, immigration, feminism, homosexuality, religious beliefs, the arts, gun control, and many other areas of American life. Invariably, they have insinuated themselves into positions of great power and influence which impact government policy on those and many other issues. It is not only President Clinton's top advisors and counselors who are Jewish. Vice President Al Gore's chief of staff is the Jew Ron Klein. So we can say that they are even prepared to mobilize in the event of the president's death or impeachment. Perhaps one of the most telling indications of the special status of Jews in the U.S. government is the startling fact that Clinton has officially appointed a position of, quote, special representative to the Jewish community, unquote. Jay Futlick's position is a unique one, as there are no, quote, special representatives for any other ethnic, racial, or religious group. There is no representative exclusively for the Irish, the Germans, or Italians, or for that matter, even Christians. But there is one for the chosen. And it's easy to see why, when one considers their incredible power. It is a power clearly understood by every president of the United States. A partial list of the key governmental position occupied by Jews appears in this chapter. This is listed by no means their complete power. Who knows how many bureaucrats are like Madeleine Albright, Jews who expect us to believe they didn't know that they were Jewish until after appointed office. The Spotlight newspaper, as well as Dr. Errol R. Fields, The Truth at Last, and I have publicly talked about her Jewish pedigree over the years, for many years, before she supposedly knew of it. One of the many low points of the Clinton administration was the pandering of the White House Lincoln bedroom for big campaign contributors. The newspaper Jewish Week proudly reports that, and I quote, "There was a definite Semitic aspect to the list," said Johns Hopkins University political scientist Benjamin Ginsburg. In fact, half or more of the White House visitors listed were Jewish. From the new DNC, Democratic National Committee chair and former president of the pro-Israel lobby, Steve Grossman, to superstar singer Barbara Streisand. That result is hardly surprising, given the special character Democratic Party fundraising, Ginsburg said. Unquote. Not only do Jews exercise great power inside the government bureaucracy and diplomatic corps, they also have disproportionate power in the lobbying organizations that most influence government. The 3 most powerful foreign policy lobbying organizations on Capitol Hill are pro-Zionist organizations, and the heads or the key administrators of many other special interest groups are Jews. They also have influence in many foundations and organizations that in turn affect politicians and government. They include groups such as the American Civil Liberties Union, the American Medical Association, the American Bar Association, and many more. Of course, they wield immense power in the press, such as Katherine Meyer Graham's Washington Post and the Sulzberger's New York Times, as well as having immense influence in television. Without question, the Jewish-dominated media constitute the most powerful governmental lobby in the world. Jewish power in government media has grown so great that they appear to think that they are unassailable. Upon the re-election of Bill Clinton to the presidency, Jewish Week, which is the largest Jewish newspaper in the United States, by the way, on January 24, 1997, reported a gathering in Washington, D.C. at the Jewish Community Center for, quote, a Jewish leadership celebration, unquote. The article makes the case that in years past, quote, Jewish leaders would not be so bold in celebrating Jewish political involvement. There were words that acknowledging Jewish successes would only reinforce anti-Semites. Jews feel secure enough in their accumulated clout. Politically, we've come out of the closet, comfortable enough with our own achievements to celebrate them openly. The Jewish community has reached a kind of critical mass in politics that guarantees that many of the gains of the Clinton years will remain no matter who occupies the White House. Unquote. No matter who occupies the White House, they boast, their immense power will remain. Are they implying that no one could even attempt to become president without subservience to their power? If that implication were made by Gentiles, it would certainly be viewed as anti-Semitic. Perhaps the most telling barometer of whether the American government has become what some refer to as a Zionist occupational government, or ZOG, is Jewish representation in our diplomatic corps. If, after all, the government is in reality a Jewish occupational government, it certainly stands to reason that its key representatives overseas reflect that fact. Now, here's an amazing list of Jewish ambassadors as of 1997, which does not include the multitude of Jewish bureaucrats and under-ambassadors serving lower-level positions. North America, Mexico, Jeffrey Davidow. Canada, Gordon Griffin. Cuba, diplomat Michael Kozak. France, Felix Roatan. Belgium, John C. Kornblum. Germany, Alan Blinken. Denmark, Edward Elson. Norway, David Hemelin. Sweden, Thomas Siebert. Switzerland, Madeleine Kunin. Poland, Daniel Fried. Hungary, Donald Blinken. Romania, Alfred Moses. Belarus, Kenneth Yalowitz. Turkey, Mark Grossman. Egypt, Daniel Kirchner. Israel, Martin Indyk. India, Frank Wiesner. New Zealand, Josiah Beeman. Morocco, Mark Ginsburg. South Africa, James Joseph. Singapore, Timothy Korba. Brazil, Melvin Levitsky. American emissaries to its three closest neighbors, Canada, Mexico, and Cuba, are Jewish. Their Ambassador Griffin, Jeffrey Davidow from Mexico, and our U.S. interest diplomat for Cuba is Michael Kozak. In the Middle East, American has Jewish ambassadors to both Israel and Egypt. Jewish diplomatic hegemony is equally impressive in Europe. And I just gave you those figures, but here's an example. Switzerland was successfully blackmailed by Edgar Bronfman's World Jewish Congress over supposed Holocaust bank accounts. America's Jewish ambassador, Madeleine Kunin, helped Bronfman. The New York Times on October 4, 1997 reported that she, quote, doggedly pursues the Swiss on the issue of gold for Holocaust survivors. Again, these are American ambassadors, they're Jewish supremacists, and again, they're pursuing, first and foremost, the Jewish and the Israeli agenda. Just as they have come to be key advisors and appointees of the President of the United States, Jews are accomplished at their Jewish partisan, team politics, and the lower echelons of power as well. They hold a vastly disproportionate share of positions of influence in groups from social clubs to labor unions. Their domination of many labor unions is an ironic display of their power, for no group in the United States is less disposed to physical labor. Such leadership may explain why union administrators have often sold out their overwhelmingly European-American membership by supporting programs such as affirmative action and taking only half-hearted actions in opposition to free trade and immigration. Once in positions of great power, they are not reluctant to use their positions to advance an agenda that often conflicts with the interests of the overall membership. In my campaigns for the U.S. Senate and for Governor of Louisiana, Jewish officials would steer diametrically opposed groups to oppose me no matter what my record was in relation to those groups. Jews and labor are anti-labor organizations. Environmental are industrial associations. Pro or anti-gun control would use their influence in those organizations to promote their own political agenda against me because of my policy in Israel. That agenda was only concerned about Israel and not the fundamental issues represented by the associations they supposedly represented. This section is called A New President, Same Jewish Agenda. In the election of George W. Bush to the American presidency in 2000, it had little effect on the overwhelming Jewish power in the American governmental bureaucracy. Although the Jewish establishment overwhelmingly supported Al Gore for president, it knew that Bush understood the political necessity of following political agendas set by supremacist Jews. Powerful Jews such as Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan continued to span both Democratic and Republican administrations. Although the Jews lost some of their more visible positions in the new Bush administration, the underlying Jewish-dominated civil service bureaucracy has continued with a multitude of Jews holding critical undersecretary and deputy positions in the State Department, Pentagon, CIA, and other important agencies. Even President Bush's primary public spokesman is appropriately Jewish. Press Secretary Ari Fleischer even shares the same ethnically derived first name as Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. And a recent director of the National Affairs Domestic Policy of the American Jewish Committee, probably the most powerful Jewish organization in America, Dr. Stephen Steinleit, wrote an essay in October 2001 about the Jewish orchestrated American immigration policy. It reveals much more than Jewish attitudes in immigration. It also exposes widespread sentiments of Jewish supremacism and power. And by the way, before I go on, as a side note, this is again a slice of time, but in just the last few months, President Bush has appointed Josh Bolton, a radical Jewish supremacist, to head up the White House. And he heads White House policy. And he even sets policy admitted by organizations and groups. And his second command is also Jewish. And they're now having meetings of Chabad Lubavitch, one of the most radical, vicious, racist, anti-Gentile organizations on the face of the earth. An organization that maintains and believes that Gentiles are part of the animal kingdom, that the entire purpose of the Gentile world and all the world is simply to serve Jews whom they believe have the DNA of God. In other words, they are walking gods in the face of the earth. And the purpose of Gentiles is simply and totally simply to serve Jews. One of the Chabad Lubavitch well-known rabbis recently in St. Louis, and this is an article that he wrote for Jewish Week, again, the largest Jewish paper, wrote that is it moral for a Jew who needs a liver to stop a non-Jew on the street and take his liver? Is that moral? And he answers basically in the affirmative, that the Torah would allow this. This is the kind of attitudes that they have, and these people are being celebrated in the White House, including their famous, what they call Great Rebbe, Rabbi Schneerson, who is celebrated and honored in the White House of the United States. Now, in his article, The Jewish Stake in America's Changing Demography, Steinleit writes a preeminent Jewish role in changing American immigration policy over the last century to the point where whites will now become a minority in America. He expresses fear that the change is now occurring so fast, although multiculturalism has been a big advantage to Jewish power, it will pose a threat unless it's allowed or slowed to allow for Jewish propagandizing of the new arrivals. He's especially concerned about Muslim immigration, arguing that their voting and lobbying might pose a danger to Jewish Mideast agenda. In making his case to his fellow Jews, he speaks guardedly, but makes some amazing admissions about Jewish power in America. And I quote, "While Jewish sensitivities continue to enjoy extraordinarily high levels of deference, and while Jewish interests continue to receive special protection, does it matter that the majority of non-European immigrants have no historical experience of the Holocaust or knowledge of the persecution of Jews over the ages and see Jews only as the most privileged and powerful of white Americans?" Unquote. Steinleit goes on to write about what he sees as a threat to Jewish power and even indirectly reveals why Jews prevent real campaign finance reform, which of course is favored by an overwhelming number of Americans. Quote, "Not that our disproportionate political power, pound for pound, the greatest of any ethnic cultural group in America, will erode all at once or even quickly. unless and until the triumph of campaign finance reform is complete, an extremely unlikely scenario, the great material wealth of the Jewish community will continue to give it significant advantages. We will continue to court and be courted by the key figures in Congress. That power is exerted within the political system from the local to national levels through soft money and especially the provision of out-of-state funds to candidates sympathetic to Israel. And as a side note, just as the money came in by the millions to my opponents in Louisiana, even for the governorship of Louisiana, because I would dare to oppose Armitti's policy. He speaks frankly about the incredible power of the Jewish-controlled media. Quote, "It is also true that Jewish economic influence and power are disproportionately concentrated in Hollywood, television, and in the news industry, theoretically a boon in terms of the formation of favorable public images of Jews and sensitizing the American people to issues of concern to Jews." Unquote. He even confesses the rampant Jewish supremacism of which most Gentiles are completely unaware. And I've made this quote many times, but it's so important. I hope that you listen very closely to every word here. My friends, you're going to have to wait for tomorrow to hear that dramatic quote from Steven Steinlight, the former head of national affairs for the largest, most powerful Jewish organization in America, a quote in which he admits that typical Jews learn a loyalty to Israel first and are taught Jewish supremacy over Gentiles in terms of morals, even intellectually. It's an amazing quotation. It's a powerful quotation. And you will continue with the final part of Chapter 6, Jewish Political Supremacy, in tomorrow's program. Remember that your help and support enables us to do this book free and enables me to continue my work speaking and educating millions of people around the world. Thank you so much for your support. Let's work hard and let's change the world together. Thanks. See you again tomorrow. This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddu.com.